Dr. David Jacobs, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Jerry?
It's good to have you back on the air with us. You've been doing a few things. Your website says you've been doing this sort of thing for 38 years. It's probably longer than that, right?
Well, actually, the website was sort of redone recently.
Okay, it is current
Yeah,
then.
it's pretty current, but time does march on, I've noticed. And every time I look in the mirror, there's some strange old guy looking back at me.
I have the same problem. And the guy's getting older, but that's another subject we don't want to get into. You've done hypnotic regressions. Your website said over 900.
Well, about 900. The last one I did was a few hours ago, actually.
Okay, so you're still at it. Now,
Still at it. There's no stopping me now.
I want to talk to you about a few things, and then we'll get into some other subjects if you wish. But first of all, am I correct in understanding that ABC actually taped a regression therapy with an abductee?
Yeah, well, every once in a while there'll be a show that wants to do a regression. They want to see what a regression looks like. And so for years I refused to do it because I just didn't, it always made me uncomfortable, but I finally succumbed and I've done a bunch from now. And what it is, it's me sitting in a chair, somebody lying on a couch or my day bed, both of us unmoving except for our lips. It's not exactly exciting television.
Yeah, I started to say. Now, I understand that part of it, but how do, so this is normally the way you work anyway, right?
Well, with a television crew, sometimes they can't come into the office. I have a special little office for this, and it's still too cramped in there. So oftentimes I'll do it in another room in my home. But Peter Jennings, I did a regression with them in mid-August, around August 13th or something like that, after having quite a lot of contact with them, I think June or May.
Oh, yeah, because I ran across them in Roswell, their third unit producer, and they were that was they put a lot of time and effort into this thing not to show anything.
Right, they had hundreds of hours of tapes. I mean, I was interviewed at length in New York. They came down and interviewed me at length here. They came down, did a regression. They interviewed me. Apart from that, I gave them some volunteer abductees, who volunteered to go on, and they wound up using the abductees who I gave them. I guess all except one or maybe two were mine.
They had some pretty weird camera angles. Now, I don't necessarily think that was nefarious on their part as much as, TV. They want to make everything look exciting and
Right, yeah. I mean, the only thing that was awful about that part was the fact that
I mean, they had great shots of people's nostrils,
But what bothered me, and I think there was obviously a lot of very bothersome things about the show. I mean, there were good things about the show. The first hour was really very good. They interviewed, they did sort of old-fashioned UFO research. They interviewed credible people who had seen incredible things. They focused on airmen and
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. That was a very good hour. And the second hour, to me,
the opposite.
Yeah, to me, a lot of people say, well, they were just sucking you in, and that may be true. I'm not saying, I don't know. I don't have any privilege information, but it just seems to me like somebody made them change directions here in the last minute, because a lot of that looked really pasted together pretty fast.
Well, yeah, they.
Have you heard any more about it?
No. This, once something like that happens, it's yesterday's news. They're on to another project, and they're doing something else, and they don't even remember who you are or what you are. This is the entertainment industry. You got to remember that this is Peter Jennings and all that, but it's all part of the entertainment.
Sure, I understand.
So you can't.
They say that about me.
And you do, when you got a daily diet of things you're trying to do, those things do happen. But it's a shame. They spend a lot of time with you, and they they did not treat Bud Hopkins very well either.
They really didn't treat him very well at all, and I mean, they had him say his piece and all that. But here's the thing, and I put a little piece about this on my website, and it'll be reprinted, I think, in UFO magazine or something. Maybe he asked for, the guy who published it asked for permission.
You know, we have a section on our website about all of this. Is it okay if we link to that?
Sure, but here's the thing. When they did the abduction part of the show, what they did was they came out with these two Harvard psychologists, McNally and Clancy, who stated primarily that this was hypnosis, fantasies, and sleep paralysis that was causing it. Now, sleep paralysis is the explanation du jour. You know, explanations for the abduction phenomenon change constantly over time. And there's been hundreds of them, and that's really not an exaggeration. It's almost uncountable how many explanations there have been for this phenomenon. But the latest one is sleep paralysis. Now, all debunkers, all of them, and there are no exceptions to this. This is one of those few areas where you can use absolutes, even though I tend to use them sort of almost all time anyway. But in this area, you really can use it. All debunkers do one or all of three things. Number one, they don't know the data. They don't know the evidence. Number two, they ignore the evidence if they do know it. Or number three, they distort the evidence to conform to their explanations. And so what you get, now here's where it all ties in. In the regression that I did for the Peter Jennings crew, I did a regression that happens in the daytime, from a car, woman was driving, stopped on the side of the road, etc. From a legitimate abductee, and they have the tape, the audio tape, and they have their own eyes. They had direct disconfirmational evidence with them. So when they chose to use the sleep paralysis argument, they had in their possession evidence to the contrary.
Yeah.
They also knew that a significant percentage of abductions are remembered without hypnosis. In fact, the one I did today was in large part remembered without hypnosis, and I have that on tape, and I did hypnosis anyway, and a lot more details came out, but basically she remembered what happened. And as Bud pointed out to them, in the first 20 years of our knowledge of the abduction phenomenon, there were no cases that happened during a person's sleep at night. We didn't have any cases like that at all. And so they had, and I told them that, and Bud told them that, and they had direct disconfirmational evidence, and they went with this sort of cockamamie sleep paralysis. Now, in order to get sleep paralysis, you have to simply ignore the evidence or distort it or just not know it. For example, as I pointed out in this little piece that I wrote on my website, I went down and counted up of the cases that I have cataloged in my computer. You know, I don't have every case in the computer, so it's going to be less than the amount of sessions that I've actually done. But approximately 60% of them were during the day or when the person was awake, and about 40% of them were during the night or when the person was asleep or both. In other words, the majority of cases that I have investigated over the past 19 years have been when a person was not sleeping, and therefore it could not possibly be sleep paralysis.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because we talk to people occasionally that call in, and we call people up that have had these experiences, and very seldom is it while they're asleep.
Right. Oftentimes those are the ones they remember the least, actually.
Right.
But the fact is that they chose to not have a rejoinder to McNally and Clancy. It could have taken 10 seconds. It could have taken 15 seconds. They chose not to do that, although one of the abductees said in passing, well, it happens when I'm not asleep. But nobody remembers that. But the fact is, though, that... that this is debunking. And so what the Peter Jennings group did was they simply chose to ignore the evidence, like all smokers do. Like I said, it's all of them do it. It doesn't, you know, they're 100%.
Yeah, so you actually have one of the subjects in a car, like where it happened originally or something?
Well, I was doing a regression. There was a missing time episode when she was driving from one point to another point.
Yes, uh-huh.
And something strange had happened there, and I had worked with her before, and she agreed to do this, you know, and we did this. And
well, they can't say that wouldn't be a good visual, because it would be.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. It would have been very interesting.
So they have no excuse.
They had no excuse whatsoever. It was actually a very interesting one with babies and all the rest of this stuff, you know. But they chose not to. Now, having said that, and of course, you know, I'm not a Roswell adherent, and I was never convinced, as everybody knows, that the evidence for Roswell is persuasive. It's not persuasive to me.
Yeah, I know, and we've talked about that before.
Right, but they were horrible on Roswell. There is a legitimate side to Roswell in terms of the argument. I don't think the argument is persuasive, but there's a legitimate argument. And they made Stanton Friedman look like some sort of self-promoter in it for the money. I don't know what, is some sort of nutcase, you know. And Stanton Friedman obviously is not that. And yet they chose to make him look that way. They were extremely unfair. There was all sorts of other problems. I mean, they talked about Alan Hynek, the only scientist who investigating it. And there was not a word said about James McDonald or others who were investigating it. Then they went and talked about Peter Davenport. He's the only researcher around today now who's doing the sightings, it seems.
I always, and I have not been able to get an answer from anyone, but I always assumed that Carl Flock and Peter Davenport were consultants for that show.
Not that I know of. I mean, it's possible, but not that I know of.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've tried to find an answer. Nobody can give it to me yet.
Right. But the point is that they simply decided to ignore. I mean, Peter Davenport is a great guy, and he does a lot of good work, and there's no doubt about that, but they simply ignored MUFON and all the other organizations that have hundreds of people around the country who are looking at sightings every day.
Well,
it just wasn't there. It was sort of crazy. Now, the point is, however, the first hour was really quite good, and if you just look at the first hour, it's without doubt the best presentation of the UFO phenomenon ever on television.
It's not a cable audience, a niche audience like we have or whatever, and it's an audience that's a general mass appeal to some extent. And, you know, they watch the first hour where they might say, hey, there's something to it.
Right. And so I think that they then used what they considered to be the fringe stuff, Roswell abductions and whatever else, and said, see, we can separate out the fact from the fiction. The first stuff is the fact, the second stuff is the fiction. And that's how they could justify it in their minds as doing a really good job. And if you look at it from that point of view, you know, well, okay, I can see their point of view. I mean, that was, they made the sightings look good.
Well, all of your stuff ended up on the cutting room floor, and I think you were lucky.
Well, I probably dodged a bullet.
Yeah.
I must say I was extremely put out after spending...
Well, sure, you spent a lot of time with them, right.
No, this was a lot of days.
Too bad we can't get a hold of that material.
Yeah, well, even in 2 weeks before the show, I sent them a whole series of drawings which they used on the show. And, I mean, I was working sort of sporadically at, you know, at their beck and call since the summer. People were that way, too.
And I think that's part of the reason when start talking to people, there's a lot of disappointment with UFO researchers and experts like you in the field who are educated, and, you know, you're a PhD, you have the degree, you can prove it, you've been practicing all this time, you're certainly not way out there, and...
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'm pretty far out.
Well, but basically, you no one's ever challenged your credentials.
No.
And that's what I'm saying, and... And Stan Friedman has some pretty good credentials, and just say that he's a book promoter was really way out in left field.
And they use some quotes that, I mean, from him, some clips that were extremely unflattering, I thought. I mean, once again, this is all a matter of choice. But what they were trying to do, it seems to me now, I don't know, and I'm not going to have anything to do with them because it doesn't really matter what they think. The only thing that matters is what was shown. But I think that what they were trying to do was to bolster the sighting aspect of it by dumping on the non-sighting aspects to show that there was a legitimate phenomenon going on here, but it wasn't Roswell and it wasn't abductions and so forth. So this is a bad way of going about doing a show, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
I understand what you're saying.
And that's that.
Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening with you. I know you're doing all, I guess 19 years, you said, that'd be your first hypnotic regression would be 1986?
That's right, in August of, August 1986 was the very first one.
And I guess you still remember that one.
Oh, I do indeed. That was a critical one for me. That ultimately turned out to be the most important regression I ever did in my life, by far.
That's a pretty big claim.
Right, and what happened in that regression was a woman had written about Hopkins because he had written Intruders. I'm sorry, he had written Missing Time, and she read Missing Time, and Bud referred her to me. I had been sort of learning about the subject for the previous 4 years, and I was ready to do regressions, and she came to me, and I had a little tape recorder that I used, and I was nervous as hell. I mean, I was literally in a cold sweat of nervousness, thinking I'm going to hypnotize somebody today, see, having never done this before in my life. So I wrote out an induction in a 3x5 card and hid it in the palm of my hand so that she wouldn't be able to see it, so that she wouldn't be able to see what a total novice I was.
Sounds like me and my first comedy job going when on stage many years ago.
Well, so I did that, and we sort of agreed that what she was going to look at an event that happened when she was a child. And she remembered sort of floating up into the air. She was with a friend on a field, and she was maybe about 7 years old or something like that. I can't exactly remember, six or seven or eight or whatever. And it was obviously suspicious, so she laid down on the couch. I put my tape recorder on, and I read out this induction as if I had done it 1,000 times, see? And now she was a channeler, and she was heavily into channeling, and she had actually conducted seminars on channeling, teaching other people how to do channeling. And of course, in those days, we had absolutely no idea what kind of significance that would have on getting stories.
That probably, were you familiar with that at all back in those days?
Yeah, we were all novices.
Well, the reason I say that is the first time I had a channeler on the air, I had no idea what was going to happen. And boy, I sit over in the corner and all of a sudden got white as a sheet and changed the voice and the whole thing. And I kept scratching my head about it because it just had been completely foreign to me.
Right. Well,
and it's about that same time period.
Yeah, well, channeling was actually, there was a huge sort of rage for it was in those days, and it's cooled off considerably now. I will say, as an aside, that channeling has absolutely nothing to do with abduction activity, and but things can get away from an incompetent hypnotist, of which I was the absolute essence of. I was Mr. Incompetence. So we did this. We went back to this period when she was a little girl, and she was on a field, and she was looking at a buttercup or a butterfly or something like that. And she was actually with a friend. And the next thing she knew, she was sort of stuck in that position, and she was being lifted up into the sky, and she was taken on board this object, and there was a guy who she had a name for, and who had a page boy hairstyle, which I thought to myself, this doesn't sound right, but who knows, you know.
Yeah, right.
And they took off her clothes, and they put her on a table, and they did this to her and that to her, and they did a little gynecological procedure that she was extremely embarrassed to talk about. And then they took her off the table, and they took her down a hallway, and in the hallway she met a small gray alien, and she was required to put her hands out and touch the gray alien's head. And when she did that, love and affection and warmth emanated from him and right into her, and she loved him and he loved her and all that. And then she took her arms, her hands off his head, and he continued on his way, and the feeling dissipated right away. And then they took her, this guy with the pageboy haircut, took her into another room, and there was sort of a council of aliens sitting there around a table, and she sat on a bench by the wall. And they said that when she grows up, she's going to be beautiful and intelligent and strong and loyal, brave and courageous and true and whatever. And then they got her out of the room and back up and did her, put her clothes back on and took her back. And I thought to myself, aha, I've done it. Oh, my goodness, I've done it. I've done a regression of an abductee. And I was like in intense excitement here. And we talked about it for a while, and then she left, and I immediately called up Bud and told him that what had happened and asked him if he'd heard this and that and so forth, you know, and trying to compare notes and all that. And that night, I decided that I would transcribe this precious tape into my computer. And in my naivete, I thought that my little portable tape recorder with its condenser mic would pick up every word she whispered. And the only thing on that tape was just a syllable every once in a while. And I broke into a cold sweat. I literally broke into a cold sweat thinking, oh, no, I've lost it. I've lost it all. Oh, this is terrible. Oh. And I decided I will remember it. And so I tried to copy down every single thing I remembered. And I learned right away, you can't do that. That's not going to happen. And I actually had a memory in those days. And but she came back for another session. She came back for another session, another one. After a couple of months, I said to her, I said, remember that first session we did? You were on the field and all that. She said, yeah. I said, well, I had a little trouble with the tape recorder, see. Which, of course, hiding the fact that I'd been a damn fool. And I said, can we redo that one? Let's do that one again. She said, sure, okay. So she's on the field. She's bending down to look at the butterfly or whatever it is. She feels herself being lifted up. She's taken on board this object. Clothes are removed. She's put on a table. They do this or that to her. They do a gynecological procedure she's very, very embarrassed to talk about. They take her off the table, they put her clothes back on, and they start to take her back. And I said, oh, well, wait a minute now. Let me back you up just a little bit. I said, remember the very, in the first session, you walked down a hallway, you know, and you met that small gray alien and all that. She thought, and she said, you know, I don't remember that happening. I said, well, then they took you into this room, and there was a council and loyal, brave, courageous, and true. And she said, you know, I think that happened to a friend of mine who told me about it, not to me. And I knew at that instant that I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I had believed things that she had told me, and I shouldn't have. I had not challenged things. I had no idea how to separate fact from fiction. There were no controls. And that was why this was such an important session, because at that point, the gift was that I was caught believing something that didn't happen. And I decided to put in a set of controls so that this did not happen again, or at least I could try to make it, to decrease the amount to zero if possible. And so from then on, I began to think about methodology and how to do this right, and what can I do to make sure that we're getting the real story here and not something a person is inventing. And so that sort of guided me ever since.
Now in your book, Secret Life, first-hand account of abductions, Simon & Schuster, and I believe a Touchstone Books has it in paperback.
Right.
You deal with quite a few interesting abduction events. Is this your latest book, or do you have something out now?
It's been two books since then.
That's what I was thinking.
Right. In 1998, The Threat came out, not my title, publisher's title. And I hate the title, but it's called The Threat. And which adds a tremendous amount more, and which expands the abduction phenomenon tremendously, and actually adds a sort of all-encompassing theory about what's going on, whereas Secret Life was sort of theory-free.
Hey, I noticed that Simon & Schuster also published that book. They just gave me the information here on it.
Right. And then in 2000, year 2000, I published an edited book with 10 authors, all of them sort of major players in UFO research. And that was published by the University Press of Kansas.
Yeah, we talked about that on the air right after it came out. UFOs and
abductions challenging the borders of knowledge, kind of a mouthful of a title.
Well, it's published by a university, so...
Well, it's published by University Press, and so far I have published the only two books by University Presses, refereed presses, that predominantly take a positive viewpoint towards the subject. I mean, the first one was in 1975, my first book, and then there's this one. Now, there have been two other books that have come close that are really quite good. One is Jody Dean's Aliens in America, which is a post-structuralist book, which means that every sentence must be puzzled over. You have to scratch your head at every sentence. It's as one person said, it's like reading through molasses. But it's brilliant, and it's wonderful. And she's a professor of political science at a college in upstate New York, Hobart Williams College.
Are you still teaching at the university?
I am, yes.
You have a UFO class this semester?
No, I'll have my UFO class next year sometime. Not sure what it will be in the spring or the fall. Anyway, the other book is called The Lure of the Edge by Brenda Densler, which is sort of a religious, a book at religions and UFOs. It's also excellent, and it was published by University of California Press. So Jody Dean's book is published by Cornell. But
you mentioned religion. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but there seems to be more spirituality these days at these conferences I go to than there used to be. Maybe not.
No, you're right. You're right. And I'm not sure what to attribute this to. I mean, of course, we are the most religious Western society in the world, and with the highest church attendance, the highest number of people who believe in an actual heaven and actual hell and all the rest of that, as the study has shown. And a lot of them have attached spirituality and the Bible to the UFO phenomenon. And you see that coming out. And I find that to be unfortunate because, when we take a look at the last 60 years almost of UFO research, you've got intrepid people who are going about doing serious, solid work, asking questions, figuring out triangulation, calling up airports, investigating witnesses for their credibility and all that, and they made the case for the uniqueness, for the reality of this phenomenon as an extraterrestrial phenomenon, an agenda of which they did not know, and of course they were doing the right thing. And when you begin to insert it into religion, then you're sort of in a whole different arena. It's a different ballgame.
Oh, I agree with you completely. I'm still a nuts and bolts guy, I guess. I'd just like to see one land, like to go knock on the door and say hello with my tape recorder running.
That would be good.
You and Bud were going to be out at Laughlin, I was hoping, and the last minute, I guess, did both of you go to Italy or one?
What happened was we had done a seminar together with his Intruders Foundation, the Dog and Pony Show, as I call it, and we don't usually do things, presentations together, but every once in a while we will. And so word of this got out, and we were invited to go down to Laughlin and do the presentation together. And the problem was that Bud had a conference in Italy like a week later. And you know, Bud is has had some health problems.
Well, he's doing pretty good now, right? He's doing okay now.
Actually health-wise.
That's what I'm talking about. I still hear people say, "Yeah, Bud's got some health problems." Well, that's not really true anymore, is it?
No. It is still true. Yeah. Unfortunately, right. It is still true.
Okay.
But he's better now than he's been in a long time, and he has some. He has one underlying health problem, and he's had some other ones recently that were on top of it and really laid him low for a matter of a couple of months.
So there's some truth to what we hear. But anyway, Bud's doing okay. He was there. I know Farah does. I saw him at the New York one, and he was doing fine. Or appeared to be. yeah, like April 2nd or 3rd.
Right now, he looks better, he sounds better, and he is better than he's been in the past couple of years, I'll say that. Because I went up there for that little conference.
Yeah, she said she saw you.
Yeah, and he looks terrific now. He's had a lot of problems. But
now, how about Professor Jacobs? You're doing pretty good, aren't you?
Well, I'm doing okay. I mean, I'm still writing this book on methodology that I've been writing since since Kenneth Arnold made his signing. I think that's when I first started writing. And I'm averaging on this book, which I've written about 200 pages of, and I got to write another 80 or 90 pages. I'm averaging about a word a week.
Well, it's not easy writing.
Well, I think the problem with it is that it's so infinitely boring to me. Oh, my goodness. It just takes all my mental energy to sit there and try to do something with this manuscript. It's so boring. I want to get on to things that are much more interesting. But I just got I've got to do this because it's become an anchor on me. It's just, you know, I can't do anything unless this book is done, and the book's taking me forever. So I'd like to finish it this summer, which I said the last three summers in a row, and be done with it. But
well, now what would you and Bud have done if I had seen you at the UFO Congress?
Well,
I mean, besides hide from me. I mean, what would you have done there at the session?
Well, we were both talking about sort of the most extreme edges of the abduction phenomenon, addressing the question of, are they here walking among us, you know, that sort of stuff.
Right. Is the guy at McDonald's really one of them?
Something like that. In other words, how far advanced is, from my point of view, it's how far advanced is the program? And from his point of view, has there been indication of them walking around in the past? And
Do you guys have answers?
Well, I have run across several cases recently which have caused me to change my mind. Because usually I just say, no, they're not here. And whenever we see them, that is to say hybrids, of course, gray aliens, if they were working at McDonald's, you might tend to notice that.
Yes.
But the hybrids who would be unnoticeable, I had thought, because my evidence led me to believe, that the maximum amount of time that anybody had ever seen them here was maybe 12 hours. Most of the time, when hybrids are around, they're just to abduct people. So they're here for, you know, 30 seconds or 20 minutes or whatever it is, just to get somebody, you know, up into a ship. However, I've run across several cases recently which suggest otherwise. And then one of these people talked about how this hybrid had stayed overnight. And as soon as he stayed overnight, that there went my theory that I've been holding to for a number of years about how they can only be here for around 12 hours. That was really, you know, the evidence was now beginning to mount, plus other cases that in fact they could be here longer. And if they can be here overnight, they can be here for a longer time. And so then the question is, well, you know, what, how many of them are here and all the rest of that stuff. And we kind of talked about that, and we don't really know, of course, but it was speculative. And you know, in the session that I did with a woman this very day, there was indication that this program that I have sort of theorized, and that this is an integration program into the society by hybrids, not by the aliens. That this is we're into it now, and we're right on the edge of it starting, and we're seeing bleed through things where we're where these hybrids are doing things that we've never heard of them doing before.
What do you mean by it?
Well, like having long conversations with people in restaurants, for example, and in a market.
Well, I have stories told to me like that by people.
Well,
and you never know.
Yeah, you never know.
And so they may be with us.
Yeah, but you have to remember that when people tell you stories, that's one thing. But when they're in my clutches, so to speak.
Yes, and you've learned the hard way to get the controls right.
Right, exactly. And I've known some of these people for years, and they start to talk about things then it's sort of a different story for me. You know, the dictum for UFO research from the time I first got interested in it in the mid-1960s was you never trust anybody's investigations or research except your own, you know, and even then you got to be careful. But so when they started to tell me these things, it takes a lot for me to move. Of course, I've moved way off the edge of reality for most people, but I think that the evidence is there for it now.
Well, now, I'm not comparing my job with yours at all, but I found over the years that the people who have become regular interviewees, subjects, so to speak, that appear on the show occasionally. I'm not talking about research specialists or people like you. I'm talking about experiencers.
That's right.
And not necessarily just in the UFO phenomenon, but people that have been involved in incidents. They tell you these stories, and then as they get to know you, it's not like they trust you or something. They may, subconsciously, there's just things that they overlooked or neglected to mention that all of a sudden comes out that are just really barn burners.
Right. Yeah, and that does happen, absolutely. The problem is the question is, are they remembering it accurately or not?
Uh-huh.
And when people remember things without the help of a competent investigator, or as I call them in this book on methodology, an investigation therapist, without the help of a person who understands both the abduction phenomenon and how hypnosis works and the problems of hypnosis, then the chances of them saying things that are distorted, saying things that are out of context, saying things that are just wrong or false memories, that becomes very, very, very high. And because they're remembering it consciously, it sort of gets written in stone in their mind.
Yeah, that's like somebody that's been telling you, exaggerating a story over the years. After a while, they really believe it themselves.
And this is, it's sort of like that. What they do is they take one part of something that happened that they remembered, and another part. The parts might be out of sequence, they might be distorted, and they take another part, and it's out of sequence, and distorted, and they take another part that is not out of sequence, and not distorted, and then they take the end, then they take the beginning, and this and that, and they put them all together into a coherent story. And they might remember, you know, like 5 minutes of it, or 10 minutes of it, and it might have been 3 hours long. And then they tell you this story, and like you said, it becomes reality. They say it over and over again, and it becomes reality. And it is reality to them. And when I do regressions on this, oftentimes the story is a lot stranger than they actually remembered, and it's a lot more difficult sometimes, and odder things have happened than they even remembered, and they will tell you right away that this is not how they remembered it, and now they're remembering it the correct way, and even though they're heavily invested in the original story. They know that, no, it didn't happen that way.
Is there a good way I've had more than one contactee, abductee, or whatever over the years say, I was doing fine until I got a hold of this therapist, and he really screwed me up.
Yeah, probably using my name in that context.
No, they didn't. But what I'm saying is you got to be careful who you do choose, right?
This is why I'm writing the book about methodology, because anybody and everybody and anybody's parakeet and dog and cat can do hypnosis. There's no rules, there's no laws, you don't have to be certified, there's nothing, there's no oversight, there's no nothing. You just do it. They don't know what to ask. They don't know, like the first time in my first session, they don't know what they're listening to. They have no idea how to ask questions that will get to some semblance of reality. And then what they'll do is they'll go ahead and tell them that it's some spiritual thing or it's garden.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then they get really, really, really confused in their minds and they try to accept it as some benevolent, wonderful thing, for example, or some demonic possession thing, for another example.
Yeah, you don't believe it's either one, do you? I mean, it's a little of maybe both or something. I don't know.
It's a different agenda. You know, I've come to believe that this is an integration program into the society, and for the life of me, I can't figure out why. And so far, nobody has told me why, and nobody asked them why either. But that's where the evidence directly points, and unfortunately, I can't get away with that. I can't get away from that. Whether maybe I can get away with it, but I can't get away from it.
Yes.
And it's a place that I don't like to be. I dislike talking about it. When I came out with that in the threat, my career at Temple University came to a very quick halt. I'll tell you that. And I mean, I'm still teaching there, but I will never be promoted or get salary increases.
Right, and that's that happens. You know, many times in academia, but it also happens even in the media. So we go back to the Peter Jennings people. God knows what kind of pressures they really have.
Yeah, well, my guess is that their pressure was just to put out a really interesting, good show that allowed Peter Jennings to be liberal about sightings, but real hard-headed about everything else.
Yeah, in many ways, that last hour kind of backs it up. It kind of looks like somebody said, wait a minute, we're going, you know, we got to put a little balance into this thing, as they say. And it could be, you know, it could have been him saying, hey.
But it could have been him saying that most of the producers were really in charge of that
sure,
program.
Sure, they always are.
Yeah, and you know, they've done a bunch of them. And they go on from that to something else.
Yeah, and what are you going off on after you get this book done this summer?
Well, this summer,
are you going to write the rest of the thing that you feel is your mission?
Yes, I am.
That is needed, even though it is probably boring.
It is unspeakably boring to me. But once I do that, then I've got two other books in my increasingly shrinking brain. And one of them is going to be about a woman who had a five-day event. She and her husband and her 10-month-old baby. And exactly what happens during a five-day event, because the only one we know about is Travis Walton. But he only remembered 20 minutes, and it was no hypnosis. So, and the 20 minutes he remembered, you've got to be very careful about whether it was true or not. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I have eight...
I know Travis and all of that, but we're not denigrating him. We're just talking about that's the way it is.
A great guy. He is extremely intelligent, very articulate, very modest, a terrific person. But we really don't know what happened to him. And whereas I have eight three-hour sessions on this five-day event, I've got 24 hours of constant testimony about this, and it doesn't seem, you know, it's not 5 days worth, but it's good enough. 24 hours of talking about one event is a heck of a long time.
Well, overall, was it your traditional event, or?
Yeah, it was, actually.
Uh-huh.
But with a whole bunch of other stuff.
Well, sure, I understand. It'd still be a good read. It'd be a good book.
Well, there's issues like how do you like that. Those uh-huh. are all important uh-huh. issues, and these are all answered in there. The next book I want to write is what do we know up to now? What has happened since the threat came out in 1998 and I wrote the book in 97? What do we know till now?
Well, great. I'm glad you're going to write that book because that's the first thing I wanted to ask you. It was Dr. Jacobs. What the hell did you find out? What's happening here?
You know, I haven't found out anything really new in all the years. Well, in the 7 years since the book came out.
Right.
Whereas in the thread, I found out all sorts of new things. And, of course, in Secret Life, I found out all sorts of new things. But I haven't found a whole heck of a lot that's new. But I've found things that add on to what, to the bare bones of what's in the thread. I can flesh this out much more now. And I can write a much more richer story about what is happening here and how it's happening and all that. And it's going to be incomplete because I still don't know the why. And once I know the why, then I can go ahead and have a life.
In other words, we've all often talked to people, and it seems to me that these UFO sightings, and especially contacts, are life-changing experiences. But it's that way for you, too.
Once I find out why this is an integration, what is the deal here? Why do they want to do what they're doing? My work will be done, I think. I think that I will have done, I will have gone as far as I can go and figure out what is happening and why it's happening. And that's all I want to do, figure out. I think I figured out what's happening, and I think I figured out how it's going to happen, and all the rest of that stuff. And the ultimate why, I don't know, unfortunately. And if I can ever get to that point before I meet my maker, then I'll be able to sit around and watch television guilt-free.
Now, final thing here, we only have about a minute left. You talked about the why. They, who are they? I mean, is this a group, a plural group, or one group?
No, what you get is small aliens and people describe larger gray aliens and then insect-like ones, and then you get ones that look more reptilian, and of course you get the hybrids, and they're various stages of hybridization. Some look more alien, some look more human. These are the, as Bud would say, Bud Hopkins, the transgenic being. In all the years that both Bud Hopkins and I have been doing this, and between the two of us, God knows how many people we've interviewed, and with him, how many thousands of sessions we've had, we have never found anything to contradict that idea. Everything is pointed to what I just said. Now, the question is, where are they from? And the answer is, we don't know where they're from. And if we knew where they were from, we'd know right now that we're dealing with something that was psychological. People don't realize that. Because with the contactees of the 1950s, the first thing the alien said when they walked out of the flying saucer to greet the human was, "Hello, my name is Thor, I come from the planet Fortek, and I come to in peace, and you have to stop atomic testing." In other words, who they are, where they're from, what they're here for.
They haven't done that.
No, they have not done that. No names that they have. That we don't know where they're from. They can't. They may not be able to tell us where they're from. It might be from a planet in a star system that doesn't even have a name. There's no way they can. They might not even be able to do that. And they don't volunteer any information like that. And they don't say hello. We don't have hellos. They don't even. There's no salutations. Well, a little interesting fact about the abduction phenomenon. We don't. There's no salutations. And no goodbye.
You know, I never thought about that, but you're right. I mean, I don't hear anybody saying, "Well, yeah, wave goodbye." And
they don't do that. It's not in their world, and so it's the whole abduction phenomenon has an internal integrity that it shouldn't have if it were psychological. So it's extremely interesting, very fascinating, and very frightening all at the same time.
We will stay in touch with you. Look forward to you finishing the book this summer and getting onto those other two, because they both sound like they're exciting reads. And
it will be a lot more exciting than the methodology book.
Thank you very much, Professor Jacobs. Enjoy it.
Gary, I appreciate it.
Okay, bye, Dave.